And prescience both are snuffed tonight, I speaked. So don't that prove savages are stronger than civilized people? It ain't savages what are stronger than civilized, Marilyn reckoned. It's big numbers what are stronger than small numbers. Smart gived us a plus for many years, like my shooter give me a plus back at Slope and Pond, but with enough hands and minds that plus'll be zeroed one day. So is it better to be a savage and to be civilized? What's the naked meaning behind them two words? Savages ain't got no laws, I said, but civilized got laws. Deeper in that, it's this. The savage satisfies his needs now. He's hungry, he'll eat. He's angry, he'll knuckly. He's swelling, he'll shoot up a woman. His master is his will, and if his will say so's kill, he'll kill, like fangy animals. Yeah, that was the Kona. Now the civilized got the same needs too, but he sees further. He'll eat half of his food now, yeah, but plant half so he won't go hungry morrow. He's angry, he'll stop and think why so he won't get angry next time. He's swelling. Well, he's got sisses and daughters what need respectin', so he'll respect his bros, sisses and daughters. His will is his slave, and if his will say so's don't, he won't, nay. So I ask again, is it better to be savage and to be civilized? Listen, savages and civilized ain't divvied by tribes or beliefs or mountain ranges. Nay, every human is both, yeah? Olin's got the smart of gods, but the savagery of jackals, and that's what tripped the fall. Some savages what I knowed got a butesome civilized heart beaten in their ribs. Maybe some Kona. Not enough to say so their whole tribe, but who knows one day. One day. One day was only a flea of hope for us. Yeah, I memory Marinim saying, but fleas ain't easy to rid. Lady Moon lit a woesome weird birthmark just below my friend's shoulder blade as she sleeped finally. A sort of tiny hand mark it were, yeah? A head a six streak strandin' off, pale against her dark skin, and I curioed why I'd never seen it before. I covered it over with a blankie so she didn't catch cold. Now Malka stream falled snaky and goshin' down dark Malka Valley, yeah? It watered only 5-6 dwellings in the whole valley, cause it weren't no friendsome and summery place, nay. No Malka dwelling did goatin', so the track was strangled by creepers and thorn bushes what it'd whelk your eye out if you didn't watch close, and hard goin' it was for the horse. I got clawed fierce after a quart mile even shelterin' behind Marinim. The last dwellin' up valley and the first we come to was Saint Sonmi's dwellin', whose chief was a one-eye named Silvestri, who farmed taro and oats. The Yibber reckoned Silvestri was too fond of his many daughters and was natural, and skink-mouthed him for not paying no fair share to commons. Laundry was scattered round the yard, and the daughters had been taken, but Silvestri had not gone nowhere. His bladed head was up on the pole watching us as we righted up. Some time he'd been there, see. He'd gotten maggoty, and a fat rat had scamped up the pole and had eaten through one eyeball as we righted up. Yeah, the whiskery devil twitched his sharp nose at me. How's it, Zachary? Don't you reckon Silvestri looks handsomer now'n before? But I didn't pay him no mind. A cockledoo erupted from the chimney pot and nearly shocked me off the horse. See, I thinked it was an ambush yell. Now we'd a choice of sorts, to farewell the horse and spider up the crumbly ridge over to Pololu Valley, or to follow the Malka trail down to the shore and risk running into stray Kona mopping up their attacking. Dwindlin' time choosed for us to stay on the horse. See, we'd to get to Iket's Finger by noon what was still 10 miles far from Silvestri's. We missed Blue Coal dwelling and Last Trout, too. See, we wasn't wreckying no more. A tide of rain skirted us down valley from the Kohalas, but we got to the shore without no ambush, though we seen fresh Kona prints beneath the knife finger palms. The ocean was no pond that day, nay. But nor so hilly a craftly oared kayak it overtoss. A Kona conch churned in the near far and vibed me uneasy. I heard my name in its churning. The air was drummed tight, and I'd ignored my second augurin. I knowed I'd be paying for that life I'd taked what weren't necessary to take. Where the rocky beach rocked up into the Medusa cliffs, we had to wind inland through banana groves to the Pololu track, what leaded out of the northliest valley into no one's land, and finally Ike's finger. The track squeezed through two fat black rocks, and we heard a whistling what was more human and bird. Marinim reached in her cloak, but before she got the shinbony, two Sharky Kona sentries had leaped down both sides on both rocks. That was four cockin'-primed crossbows aimed right at our heads from inches. Through rubbery trees, I spied a whole dammit Kona platoon. A dozen horsemen or more was sitting around a tentment, and I knowed we was finished, so near the end and all. "Passcode, horsemen," barked one sentry. "What's this, soldier, and why?" Another jiggered his crossbow at my nips. "A valley's boy's ass smearing a good Kona horse? Who's your general, horseman?" I was fearing diresome, and I knowed I looked it. Marinim did an eerie and angry yarling growl and looked through her helmet at the four, then rupted a shout out so blasphem, birds skimmed off crawling, and her tongue slant was buried under fury and noise. "How dare you, damn it, rat-shat hog-slits, address a general in that manner? My slave's ass'll smear wherever and whenever I say so. Who's my general? My general is me, you damn it, worm's bladders. Off that rock, this split beat, and bring me your captain now, or I vow by all the war gods I'll have you peeled and nailed to the nearest hornet tree." A desperate and freak-birth plan, yeah. Marinim's bluff victory just one beat, and one beat was nearly enough. Two sentries paled and lowered their crossbows and jumped down in our path. Two more disappeared the back way. Kss, kss. Them two Kona before us didn't get up no more. Marinim's sudden-wise heel digged, and our horse whinnied and reared and bolted, and my balance was busted. Sonmi's hand stayed me on the saddle, yeah, 'cause if hers didn't, whose did? Shouts and stops and conks ruckused behind us, and the horse galloped, and a f-squang as the first crossbow bedded into a bough I ducked under, then a crackle of pain flamed in my left calf just here, and I got that sick and calm shock you get when your body knows something's way too busted for an easy mending. Look, I'll roll my trousers and you can see the scar where the crossbow tip bedded. Yeah, it hurt as much as it looks it hurt, and more. We was galloping down Pololu track now over knotty and rooty ground, faster and surfing inside a roller, and it's hard to stay balanced, and there was nothing I could do about the seas and agony except grip Marinim's waist tighter and tighter and try and ride the horse's rhythm and with my right leg, or I'd be tossed right off, yeah, and there'd not be no time to mount me on again before the Kona and their bone-drilling crossbolts catched us up. The track leaded through the scalp-brushing tunnel of trees to the Olden's bridge over the Pololu River's seamouth, what marked the valley's northerly boundary. Now we was just 100 paces shy of this bridge when the sun unclouded, and I looked ahead, and its worn planking burned bright and gold, and its rusted struts was shaded bronze. My pain shaked loose a memory, yeah? My third augurin. Bronze is burning. Let that bridge be not crossed. I couldn't splain to Marinim on a galloping horse, so I just yelled in her ear, "I'm hit!" She pulled up the horse a yard shy of the bridge. "Where?" "My left calf," I tell her. Marinim looked back, anxious and diresome. Weren't no sign of our chasers yet, so she swung down to the ground and peered at the pain. She touched my wound, and I groaned. "Right now the shaft's plugging the wound, yeah? We got to get to friend some ground first, then I'll..." Drumming of vengesome hoofs was nearing a Pololu track. I told her then we couldn't cross that bridge. What? She twisted to fix my eyes. Zachary, are you saying that bridge ain't safe? Now, so far as I knowed, the bridge was strong enough. See, I often take Jonas Goleg in Northley when he was littler, and McAuliffe, a last trout, went seal hunting over it with his handcart most moons. But an iconry dreamin' didn't lie. Nay, not ever. An abbess had made me memory my augurins for a spesh day, and that day was now. I'm saying, I said, son me telled me not cross to it. Fear made Marinim sarky. See, she was just human like you and me. And did son me know we got a furian swarm of Kona on our tail? Pololu River is wide at its sea mouth, I teached her, so it ain't whooshin' deep, nor its current so sinewy. The track forked before the bridge right where we was, yeah, and it leaded down just a stretch away where we could ford the river. The hoofs drummed closer and closer, and soon the Kona'd be seeing us. Well, Marinim believed my lonesome say-so. I couldn't say why, but she did. And soon the bright and cold Pololu was up numbing my wound, but the horse was slipping diresome on the shingly riverbed. Parum, parum. Three Kona galloped onto the bridge and seen us, and the air round us quavered and slit with one crossbolt. Two, the third hit the water and sprayed us. Three new Kona catched up the first three and didn't stop to shoot. Nay, they was Pararum and crossed the Pololu bridge to cut us off on the far bank. Desperate I was, cussin' myself. Yeah, we're dyed lardbirds, no frettin', I was thinking. Now you know when you adds down a tree for lumber, the noise after the last stroke of fibers shriekin' and the whole trunk groanin' slowsome as it falls? That's what I heard. See, one or two valleysmen crossin' hushly with a handcart was one thing, but a gallopin' horse was another, and six, seven, eight gallopin' Kona armored war horses was too much. That bridge busted like it was made of spit and straw, yeah? Struts snapped and plankin' split, and worn cables pinged. It weren't no little drop, nay. It was 15 men high or more was Pololu Bridge. Down fell the horses, spinning belly up, the riders catched in their stirrups and all, and like I said, the Pololu River weren't a safe deep pool what'd catch 'em and buoy 'em up, nay. It was a crowded river of fat, tabley and pointy rocks what busted their falls bad, diresome bad. None of the Kona got up. Nay, just two, three sorrysome horses lay writhin' and kickin', but it weren't no time for animal doctrine, nay. Well, my yarn's nearly done and telled now. Marinim and me forded the far side, and I prayed my thanks to Sonmi, though there weren't no valleys civilized to save no more. She'd saved my skin one last time. I suppose the rest of the Kona platoon was too busy with their died and drowned to come tracking us to, yeah? We crossed the lonesome dunes and finally reached Iket's Finger with no accidents. No kayaks was waiting yet, but we dismounted and Marinim used her smart on that crossbolt-mauled calf of mine. When she pulled the bolt out, the pain traveled up my body and hooded my senses, so true be telled, I didn't see the Maui kayaks arriving with the Wathasite. Now my friend had a choice to settle, yeah? See, either she loaded me in that kayak or left me on Big Isle not able to walk nor nothing, just a short ride off from Kona ground. Well, here I am yarning to you, so you know what Marinim settled. And times are, I regret her choosing, yeah? And times are, I don't. The shanty of my new tribe's rowers waked me halfway across the straits. Marinim was changing my bleeded binding. She'd used some smart medicine to numb its pain a whole lot. I watched clouds a-wobbly from the floor of that kayak. Souls cross ages like clouds cross skies. And though a cloud's shape, nor hue, nor size don't stay the same, it's still a cloud, and so is a soul. Who can say where the clouds blowed from? Or who the soul be morrow? Only Sonmi, the east and the west, and the compass and the atlas. Yeah, only the atlas of clouds. The Wathasite saw my eyes open and pointed me Big Isle, purple in the sou'easterly blue, and Mauna Kea hiding its head like a shy bride. Yeah, my whole world and whole life was shrink enough to fit in the O of my finger and thumb. Zachary, my old pa, was a weird bugger. I won't naysay it now he's died. Oh, most of Pa's yarnins was just musy duck fartin', and in his lonesome old age, he even believed marrying him the prescient was his fresh beloved son me. Yeah, he sisted it. He said he knowed it all by birthmarks and comets and all. Do I believe his yarn about the Kona and his fleeing from Big Eye? Most yarnins got a bit of true. Some yarnins got some true, and a few yarnins got a lot of true. The stuff about marrying him the prescient was mostly true, I reckon. See, after Pa died, my sis and me civied his gear, and I finded his silvery egg what he named Orison in his yarns. Like Pa yarned, if you warm the egg in your hands, a beautsome ghost girl appears in the air and speaks in an olden tongue what no one alive understands nor never will, nay. It ain't smart you can use, 'cause it don't kill Kona pirates nor feel empty guts. But some dusks my kin and bros will wake up the ghost girl just to watch her hoverin' and shimmerin'. She's beautsome, and she mazes the little uns and her murmurin's babby by our babbits. Sit down a beat or two. Hold out your hands. Look.
An Orison of Somni 451. Then who was Heju'im, if he was not exactly who he said he was? I surprised myself by answering that question. Union. Heju said, "That honor is mine to bear, yes." Zili, the student, was extremely agitated. Heju told me I could trust him, or be dead in a matter of minutes. I nodded assent. I would trust him. But he had already lied to you about his ID. Why believe him this time? How did you know for sure he wasn't abducting you? I did not know. I was not sure. My decision was based on character. I could only hope time would prove it well-founded. We abandoned the ancient Cavendish to his fate and fled to our own. Down corridors, through fire doors, avoiding lights and people where possible. Heju carried me down flights of stairs. We could not wait for me to navigate them unaided. In a sub-basement, Mr. Chang waited in a plain Ford. There was no time for greetings. The vehicle screamed into life and accelerated through tunnels and empty Ford parks. Mr. Chang glanced at his Sony, reporting that the slipway still appeared to be accessible. Heju ordered him to proceed there, then got a flick knife from his pouch and sliced off the tip of his left index, gouged, and extracted a tiny metallic egg. He threw it out of the window and ordered me to discard my soul ring similarly. Zi Li also extracted his soul. Union men really cut out their own eternal souls? I always thought that was an urban myth. How else can a resistance movement elude unanimity? They would risk detection whenever they passed a traffic light otherwise. The Ford rounded a ramp when a blizzard of phosphate fire shot in the windows. Glass filled the air. Metal panels groaned. The Ford scraped along walls, jarring to an abrupt stop. From my crouch, I heard Colt fire. The Ford wailed and sped into motion. A body thumped off the vehicle. A human wailing of unendurable pain rose from the front seat. Heju held a hand Colt against Zili's head and fired. What? His own man? Why? Unanimity dum-dums combine calodoxylin and stimulin. Calodoxylin is a poison that fries the victim in agony, so his screams give his position away. Stimulin prevents him from losing consciousness. Zili slumped over into a fetal position. Heju'im, the cheerful post-grad I had known, was gone. So thoroughly that I wondered now if he had ever really been there. Rain and wind blew in. Mr. Chang drove at high speed down a garbage alley barely wider than the Ford, ripping out drain pipes. He slowed as he joined the campus perimeter road. Ahead were red and blue flashes at the campus gates. A hovering arrow thrashed the trees, sweeping the traffic with a searchlight. Loudspeakers gave incoherent orders to who knew whom. Mr. Chang warned us to brace, killed the engine, and swerved off the road. The Ford bucked, its roof whacked my head. Somehow Heiju wedged me under him. The Ford gathered speed, weight, and weightlessness. The final drop shook free an earlier memory of blackness, inertia, gravity, of being trapped in another Ford. Where was it? Who was it? Bamboo splintered, metal tore, my ribs slammed the floor. Silence, finally. The Ford was dead. Next, I heard insect songs, rain on leaves, followed by urgent whispers drawing near. I was crushed under Heiju. He stirred, groaning. I was bruised, but unbroken. Needle light hurt my eyes. An outside voice hissed, "Commander Im?" Mr. Chang responded first, "Get this door open." Hands lifted us out. Zili's body was left where it lay. I glimpsed a succession of anxious faces, resolute faces, faces that rarely slept. A company of Union men. I was carried into a concrete shack and lowered down a manhole. "Don't worry," Heiju told me. "I'm right here." My hands gripped rusty rungs. My knees scraped along a short tunnel. More arms lifted me into a mechanic shop, then lowered me into a smart two-seater exec Ford. I heard more orders issued, then Heiju swung in and started the engine. Mr. Chang had disappeared once again. Ahead, garage doors jerked open. Next, I remember gentle rain, suburb back lanes, then a jammed throughway. The Fords around us held lonely commuters, couples on dates, small families, some placid, some rowdy. When Heiju spoke, finally, his voice was cold. "If a dum-dum ever scratches me, euthanize me as quickly as I did Zili." I had no response. "You must have 100 questions on me. I beg your patience a little longer. If we are captured now, believe me, the less you know, the better. We have a busy night ahead of us. First, we're paying a visit to Huam Dong-gil. Do you know that zone of the Conurb, archivist?" "My ministry would expel me if I were ever eyed in that Untermensch slum. But please, describe it for my Orison." "Huam Dong-gil is a noxious maze of low, crooked ramshacks, flop houses, pawn shops, drug bars and comfort hives, covering perhaps 5 square miles southeast of Old Seoul Transit Station. Its streets are too narrow for Fords to enter. Its alleys reek of waste and sewage. Shitcorp goes nowhere near that quarter. Heiju left the Ford in a lockup and warned me to keep my head hooded. Fabricants stolen here end up in brothels, made serviceable after clumsy surgery. Pure blood slumped in doorways, skin inflamed by prolonged exposure to the city's scalding rain. One boy lapped water from a puddle on his hands and knees. Migrants with NSF or lead lung, Heiju told me. Hospitals drain their souls until they've only got enough dollars for a euthanasia jab or a ride to Huam Dong-gil. These poor bastards made the wrong choice. I could not understand why migrants fled production zones for such a squalid fate. Heiju listed malaria, flooding, drought, rogue crop genomes, parasites, encroaching deadlands, and natural desire to better the lives of their children. Papasong Corp, he assured me, seems humane if compared to factories these migrants ran away from. Traffickers promise it rains dollars in the 12 cities, and migrants yearn to believe it. The truth never filters back, for traffickers operate only one way. Heiju steered me away from a meowing two-headed rat. They bite. I asked why the Juche tolerates this in its second capital. "Every corner," my guide answered, "has a chemical toilet where the city's unwanted human waste disintegrates quietly, but not quite invisibly. It motivates the downstrata. Work, spend, work," says slums like Huam Dong-gil, "or you too will end your life here. Moreover, entrepreneurs take advantage of the legal vacuum to erect ghoulish pleasure zones for upstrata bored with more respectable quarters. Huam Dong-gil can thus pay its way in taxes and bribes. Medicorp opens a weekly clinic for dying Untermensch to exchange any healthy body parts they may have for a sack of euthanase. Organic Corp has a lucrative contract with the city to send in a daily platoon of immune-genomed fabricants, similar to disaster men, to mop up the dead before the flies hatch. Heiju then told me to stay silent. We had reached our destination. Which was where, exactly? Exactly, I cannot say. Wamdongil is not grid-numbered or charted. It was an overhanging mahjong house with a high lintel to keep the drain water out, but I doubt I could identify the building again. Heiju knocked on a reinforced door. An eyehole blinked, bolts unclacked, and a doorman opened up. The doorman's body armor was stained dark, and his iron bar lethal-looking. He grunted at us to wait for Ma Arachna. I wondered if he wore a fabricant's collar under his neckplate. A smoky corridor bent out of view, walled with paper screens. I heard mahjong tiles, smelled feet, watched exotically clad pureblood servers carry trays of drinks. Their hassled expressions morphed to girly delight every time they slid open a paper screen. I copied Heiju's example and removed my Nikes, dirtied by the Huamdongil alleyways. "Well, you wouldn't be here if the news wasn't bad," the speaker addressed us from the ceiling hatch. Whether her webbed lips, crescent eyes, and thorny voice were the results of genoming or mutation, I could not guess. Her gem-warted fingers gripped the hatch ridge. Heiju addressed Ma Arachna as Madam. A cell had turned cancerous, he updated her. Mephi was under arrest. Zili was dum-dummed and killed. So yes, the news could hardly be worse. Ma Arachna's double tongue uncurled and curled once or twice. She asked how far the cancer had spread. The union man replied he was here to answer that very question. The madam of the establishment told us to proceed to the parlor without delay.
The parlor?
A gap room behind a roaring kitchen and a false wall, lit by a weak solar. A cup of ruby lime waited on the rim of a cast-iron brazier that surely predated the building, if not the city. We sat on well-worn floor cushions. Heiju sipped the drink and told me to unhood. The plank ceiling thumped and creaked. A hatch flipped open, and Ma Arachna's face appeared. She expressed no surprise at seeing me, a sonmi. Next, the ancient brazier hummed with extremely modern circuitry. A sphere of dark sheen and refracted silence expanded until it filled the parlor, aquifying the kitchen noises. Lastly, a piebald light above the brazier morphed into a carp.
A carp?
A carp as in the fish. A numinous pearl and tangerine, fungus-blotted, mandarin-whiskered, half-meter-long carp. One lazy slap of its tail propelled the fish toward me. Roots of water lilies parted as it moved. Its ancient eyes read mine. Its lateral fins rippled. The carp sank a few centimeters to read my collar, and I heard my name spoken by an old man. Heiju was barely visible through the murky underwater air.
"I am sorely thankful to see you alive," the 3D's transceived voice was cultured but muffled and splintered, "and truly honored to meet you. I am Angkor Apis of Union."
The fish apologized for the visual dramatics. Camouflage was necessary since unanimity was combing all transmissions. I responded that I understood. Angkor Apis promised I should understand much more very soon and swung toward Heiju, Commander Im. Heiju bowed, reporting that he had euthanized Zi Li. The senior union man said he already knew that no anesthetic existed for Heiju's pain, but that unanimity had killed Zi Li, and Heiju had merely spared his brother an ignoble death in a prison cube. Apis then exhorted Heiju to ensure Zi Li's sacrifice was not in vain. A short briefing followed. 6 cells had been compromised and 12 more firebraked. The good news was that Boardman Mephi had managed to suicide before neurotorture could begin. Angkor Apis then ordered my companion to exit me from Seoul through West Gate 1, to proceed to the northern camp in a convoy, and to reflect well upon what had been advised. The carp circled, vanishing into the parlor wall before reappearing through my chest. "You have chosen your friends wisely, Sonmi. Together,
we may change corpocratic civilization out of all recognition. He promised we would meet again soon. The sphere then shrank back into the brazier as the parlor restored itself. The carp became a streak of light, a dot, finally nothing at all.
How was Heiju planning to pass through a city exit without souls?
The soul implanter was ushered in just minutes later. A slight, anonymous-looking man. He examined Heiju's torn finger with professional disdain. He tweezered the tiny egg from his gel pack, bedded it into fresh tissue, and sprayed cutane over the top. That such an insignificant-looking dot can confer all the rights of consumerdom on its bearers, yet condemn the rest of corpocracy to servitude seemed, and still seems, a bizarre obscenity to me.
Your name is Ok Kyun Pyo, the implanter told Heiju, adding that any Sony would download his fictional history. The implanter turned to me and produced a pair of laser pliers. They would cut steel but not even scratch living tissue, he assured me. First he removed my collar. I heard a click, felt a tickling as it pulled away. Then it was in my hands.
That felt odd. As if you were to hold your own umbilical cord, archivist.
Now for the subcutaneous barcode.
He swabbed anesthetic over my throat, warning me this would hurt, but his tool's damper would stop the barcode from exploding on contact with air.
Ingenious, Heiju peered.
Of course it's ingenious, retorted the implanter. I designed it myself. Sickening thing is, I can't patent it. He had Heiju stand ready with a cloth. A jagged pain tore my throat. As Heiju staunched the bleeding, the implanter showed me the old identity of Somni 451, a microchip and a pair of tweezers. He would dispose of it himself, he promised, carefully. He sprayed healant over my wound and applied a skin-tone dressing. And now, he continued, a crime so novel it doesn't even have a name. The souling of a fabricant. How is my genius rewarded? A fanfare, a Nobel, and a university sinecure?
A paragraph in the history of the struggle against corpocracy, said Heiju.
Wow, thanks, brother, replied the implanter. A whole paragraph. This surgery was swift also. The man laid my right palm on a cloth, sprayed coag and anesthetic onto my index finger pad, made an incision less than a centimeter, inserted a sole, and applied cutane. This time his cynicism betrayed a core of sincerity.
May your soul bring you fortune in your promised land, Sister Yun Ah Yu.
I thanked him. I had all but forgotten Ma Arak Na watching from her ceiling hatch, but now she spoke. Sister Yu best get a new face for her new soul, or some awkward questions'll crop up between here and the Promised Land.
So I suppose your next destination was the Facecaper.
It was. The doormen escorted us as far as Togyero Street, Huamdongil's boundary with its nearest semi-respectable neighborhood. We metroed to a once fashionable galleria in Shincheon and escalated up through chiming chandeliers. They took us to a warren-like precinct on canopy level, frequented only by consumers quite sure of their destination. Twists and turns were lined with discreet entrances and cryptic nameplates. Down a dead end, a tiger lily bloomed in a niche by a plain door.
Don't speak, Heiju warned me. This woman's prickles need cosseting.
He rang the bell. The tiger lily striped bright. It asked us what we wanted. Heiju said we had an appointment with Madame Ovid. The flower flexed to peer at us and told us to wait. The door slid open.
I am Madame Ovid, announced a bone-white pureblood. Dew drugs had frozen her harsh beauty in its mid-twenties long ago. Her voice was a buzzsaw.
You have no appointment, whoever you are. This is an upstrata establishment. My biocosmeticians accept only recommendations. Try a mask grafter on one of the lower floors. The door shut in our faces. Heiju cleared his throat and spoke into the tiger lily.
Kindly inform the estimable Madame Ovid that Lady Him Young sends her earnest and cordial regards. A pause ensued. The Tiger Lily blushed and asked if we had traveled far. Heiju completed the code. Travel far enough, you meet yourself. The door opened, but Madame Ovid's disdain remained. Who can argue with Lady Him Young? She ordered us to follow, no dawdling. After a minute of curtained corridors tiled with light and sound absorbers, a silent male assistant joined us from thin air, and a door opened into a brighter studio. Our voices returned. Tools of the facecaper's trade gleamed in the sterile solar. Madame Ovid asked me to unhood. Like Madame Ma Arachna, she did not evince surprise. I doubt a lady of her stratum had ever set foot in a Papasong dinery. Madame Ovid asked how long the treatment was to last. When Heiju told her we had to leave in 90 minutes, our hostess lost her needle-sharp sang-froid. Why not do the job yourself with gum and lipstick? Does Lady Him Young take Tiger Lily for a discount trowlers with before and after Kodaks in the window? Heiju hastened to explain we were not expecting the full morph, only cosmetic adepts to fool an eye or a casual glance. He admitted 90 minutes was a ludicrously short time, hence Lady Him Young needed the best of the best. The proud facecaper saw his flattery, but was not immune. It is true, she boasted, that nobody, nobody sees the face within the face as I do. Madame Ovid angled my jaw, saying she could alter my skin, color, hair, lids, and brows. Eyes, we must dye a pure blood color. Dimples could be punched in, and my cheekbones muted. She promised to make the best of our 89 precious minutes. So what happened to Madame Ovid's artistry? You looked like a sanmi fresh from the womb tank. Unanimity refaced me for my peak-time courtroom appearances. A star actress must look the part. But I assure you, when I exited the Tiger Lily, buzzing with face-ache, not even Seer Ri would have known me. My ivory irises were hazeled, my eyes lengthened, my follicles ebonized. Consult the codex taken at my arrest if you are curious. Madame Ovid did not say goodbye. Outside, a golden boy with a red balloon waited by the escalator. We followed him to a busy Ford Park below the Galleria. The boy had disappeared, but the balloon was strung on the wiper of a cross-country vehicle. This we drove down Thruway 1 for the East Gate 1. East Gate 1, the union leader, Apis, had ordered you west. Yes, but the leader had also suffixed his orders with, reflect well upon what has been advised, meaning invert these orders. Thus, west meant east, north meant south. Travel in a convoy meant travel alone. That's a dangerously simple crypto, it seems to me. Meticulous brains will overlook the simple. As we sped along the thruway, I asked my companion if Heiju Im was a real name or false. The union man responded that no names were real for individuals of his calling. The exitway down-curved to the toll gates, and we slowed to a crawl. Ahead, each driver in line reached through the Ford window to eye his soul. Enforcers were stopping Fords for random questioning, worryingly for us. 1 in 30, approx, Heiju muttered. Pretty long odds. Our turn at the scanner came. Heiju placed his index on the eye. A shrill alarm sounded, and the barrier shot down. Fords around us prevented any hope of escape. Heiju hissed at me. Keep smiling. Act vapid. An enforcer strode up, jerking his thumb. Out! Heiju obeyed, grinning boyishly. The enforcer demanded a name and destination. Okyampyo. Even Heiju's voice had changed. Officer, we're driving to a motel in an outer conurb. Heiju glanced around and did a hand gesture whose lewd meaning I had learned from Boom Suk and his friends. How far was this motel? The enforcer demanded. Didn't he know it was already past hour 23? Motel Bang Bang, you're dead in Yeoju. Heiju adopted an idiotic conspiratorial tone. Snug place, reasonable rates. They'd probably let an enforcer sample the facilities gratis. Only 30 minutes in the fast lane, eastbound exit 10. He promised we could be there before curfew with time to spare.
What happened to your index finger?
Oh, is that why the eye blinked? Heiju did a stage groan and rambled. He had cut it de-stoning a natural avocado at his aunt's house. Blood everywhere, only stoneless avocados for him from now on. Nature was more trouble than it was worth. The enforcer peered into the ford and ordered me to unhood. I hoped my fear would come over as coyness. He asked if my boyfriend talked this much all the time. I nodded shyly. Was that why I never spoke? Yes, sir, I said. Sure he would recognize me as a Sanmi. Yes, officer. The enforcer told Heiju, girls are obedient and demure until they have you married. Then they start yakking and never shut up. Get going, he said. Where did you really curfew that night? Not a seedy motel.
No. We exited the overway at exit 2, then forked onto an unlit country lane. A dike of thorned pines hid an industrial field of 100-plus units. So close to curfew, our Ford was the only vehicle in motion. We parked and crossed a windy forecourt to a concrete block signed Hydra Nursery Corp. Heiju's soul blinked the roller door open. Inside was not a horticulture unit, but a red-lit ark, roofing giant tanks. The air was uncomfortably warm and moist. The tangled, stringy broth I saw through the tank's viewing windows concealed their contents for a moment. Then individual limbs and hands came into focus, nascent, identical faces.
Womb tanks?
Yes. We were in a genomics unit. I watched the clusters of embryo fabricants suspended in uterine gel. I was witnessing my own origin, remember? Some slept, some sucked thumbs, some scurried a hand or foot as if digging or running. I asked Heiju, had I been cultivated in that place? Heiju said no. Papa Song's nursery in Kwangju is 5 times bigger. The embryos I was looking at had been designed to labor in uranium tunnels under the Yellow Sea. Their saucer-like eyes were genomed for darkness. In fact, they go insane if exposed to bright, unfiltered daylight. The heat soon had Heiju shiny with sweat.
You must need soap, Sanmi. Our penthouse is this way. A penthouse? In a fabricant nursery?
The union man was fond of irony. Our penthouse was a nightman's sparse room, a concrete-walled space containing only a water shower, a single cot, a desk, a stack of chairs, a choked aircon, and a broken ping-pong table. Fat pipes throbbed hot across the ceiling. A Sony panel monitored the womb tanks, and a window overlooked the nursery. Heiju suggested I take a shower now, as he could not guarantee one tomorrow night. He strung up a tarp for privacy and built a bed from chairs for himself while I washed my body. A sack of soap was waiting on the cot with a set of new clothes.
You didn't feel vulnerable, sleeping in the middle of nowhere, without even knowing Heiju Im's true name.
I was too toxed. Fabricants stay awake for over 20 hours thanks to soap. Then we drop. When I woke a few hours later, Heiju was snoring on his cloak. I studied a scab of clotted blood on his cheek, scratched as we fled Temosan. Pure blood skin is so delicate compared to ours. His eyeballs gyred behind their lids. Nothing else in the room moved. He may have said Zili's name, or perhaps it was just noise. I wondered which eye he was when he dreamed. Then I blinked my soul on Heiju's hand, Sony, to learn about my own alias, Yun Ah Yu. I was a student genomicist, born 2nd month 30th in Neju during the Year of the Horse. Father was a Papa Song's aide, mother a housewife, no siblings. The data onscrolled for tens of pages, hundreds. The curfew faded away. Heiju woke, massaging his temples. Oh Kyampyo would love a strong cup of Starbuck. I decided the time had come to ask the question that had seized me in the Disneyarium. Why had Union paid such a crippling price to protect one experimental fabricant? Ah, Heiju mumbled, and picked sleep from his eyes. Long answer, long journey.
More evasion?
No.
He answered as we drove deeper into the country. I shall precede it for your Orison, archivist. Neosocopros is poisoning itself to death. Its soil is polluted, its rivers lifeless, its air tox-loaded, its food supplies riddled with rogue genes. The downstrata cannot buy drugs to counter these privations. Melanoma and malaria belts advance northward at 40 kilometers per year. Those production zones of Africa and Indonesia that supply consumer zones are now 60+% uninhabitable. Corpocracy's legitimacy, its wealth, is drying up. The douche's rounds of new enrichment statutes are sticking band-aids on hemorrhages and amputations. Corpocracy's only strategy is that long favored by bankrupt ideologies, denial. Downstrata purebloods fall into Untermensch sinks. Execs merely watch, parroting Catechism 7. A soul's value is the dollars therein. But what would be the logic in allowing downstrata purebloods to end in places like Kwamdong-gil? As a class, what could replace their labor? Us, fabricants, we cost almost nothing to manufacture and have no awkward hankerings for a better, freer life. We conveniently expire after 48 hours without a specialized soap, and so cannot run away. We are perfect organic machinery. Do you still maintain there are no slaves in Neosocopris? And how did Union aim to extract these alleged ills of our state? Revolution. But as the Boardman's anthem says, Neosocopros is the world's only rising sun. Pre-skirmish East Asia was the same chaos of sickly democracies, democidal autocracies, and rampant deadlands that the rest of the world still is. If the douche had not unified and coordinized the region, we would have backslid to barbarism with the rest of the globe. How can any rational organization embrace a creed that opposes corpocracy? Not only is it terrorism, but it would be suicide. All rising sun set, archivist. Our corpocracy now smells of senility. Well, you seem to have embraced Union propaganda wholeheartedly, Sonmi 451. And I might observe that you have embraced corpocracy propaganda wholeheartedly, archivist. Did your new friends mention exactly how Union plans to overthrow a state with a standing pureblood army of 2 million, backed by a further 2 million fabricant troops? Yes, by engineering the simultaneous ascension of 6 million fabricants. Fantasy. Lunacy. All revolutions are until they happen. Then they are historical inevitabilities. How could Union possibly achieve this simultaneous ascension? The battlefield, you see, is neuromolecular. A few hundred Union men in womb tank and soap plants could trigger these vast numbers of ascensions by adding Suleiman's catalyst into key streams. What damage could even 10 million, say, ascended fabricants inflict on the most stable state pyramid in the history of civilization? Who would work factory lines, process sewage, feed fish farms, extract oil and coal, stoke reactors, construct buildings, serve in dineries, extinguish fires, man the cordon, fill Exxon tanks, lift, dig, pull, push, sow, harvest? Now do you begin to see? Purebloods no longer possess these core skills upon which our corpocracy or any society rests. The real question is, what damage could 6 million ascensions not inflict, in combination with cordonlanders and downstrata purebloods, such as those in Kwamdong-gil with nothing to lose? Unanimity would maintain order. Enforcers aren't all Union agents. Even Una 939 chose death over slavery. And your role in this proposed rebellion? My first role was to provide proof that Suleiman's ascension catalyst worked. This I had done, and still do, simply by not degenerating. The requisite neurochemicals were being synthesized in underground factories throughout the 12 cities. Your second role, Heiju informed me that morning, would be ambassadorial. General Apis wished me to act as an interlocutor between Union and the ascending fabricants, to help mobilize them as revolutionaries. How did you feel about being a figurehead for terrorists? Trepidation. I was not genomed to alter history, I told my fellow fugitive. Heiju countered that no revolutionary ever was. All Union was asking for now, he urged, was that I did not reject a piece's proposal out of hand.
Weren't you curious about Union's blueprint for the brighter tomorrow? How could you know the new order would not give birth to a tyranny worse than the one it expired? Think of the Bolshevik and Saudi Arabian revolutions. Think of the disastrous Pentecostalist coup of North America. Surely a program of incremental reforms, of cautious steps, is the wisest way to proceed.
You show extraordinary erudition for an eighth stratum, archivist. I wonder if you encountered this dictum, first spoken by a 20th century statesman. An abyss cannot be crossed in two steps.
We're circling a contentious course on me. Let's return to your journey.
We reached Swanbow Plain around hour 11, via minor routes. Crop dusters strewed clouds of saffron fertilizer, blanking the horizons. Exposure to ISATs worried Heiju, so we took a Timber Corp plantation track. It had rained during the night, so pools bogged the dirt track, and progress was slow, but we saw no other vehicle. The Norfolk pine rubberwood hybrids were planted in rank and file, and created the illusion that trees were marching past our ford in a billion-strong regiment. I got out only once, when Heiju refilled the Exxon tank from a can. The plain had been bright, but inside the plantation even noon was dank, hushed dusk. The sole sound was a sterile wind swishing blunted needles. The trees were denomed to repel bugs and birds, so the stagnant air stunk of insecticide. The forest left as abruptly as it had arrived, and the topography grew hillier. We traveled east, the Woraksan Range to our south, and Chungju Lake spreading north. The lake water stunk of effluent from its salmon net ponds. Crosswater hills displayed mighty corp logos. A malachite statue of Prophet Malthus surveyed a dust bowl. Our track underpassed the Chungju-Taegu-Pusan expressway. Heiju said we could be in Pusan within 2 hours if he dared join it, but a slow crawl through backcountry was safer. Our potholed but eyeless road switched back up into the Sobek-San Mountains.
Heiju Im wasn't trying to get to Pusan in one day.
No. At approx hour 17, he hid the ford in an abandoned lumber yard, and we struck out on foot. My first mountain hike fascinated me as much as my first drive through Seoul. Limestone bulges oozed lichen, fir saplings and mountain ash grew from clefts. Clouds scrolled. The breeze was fragrant with natural pollen. Once genomed moths spun around our heads, electron-like. Their wings' logos had mutated over generations into a chant syllabary, a small victory of nature over corpocracy. On an exposed rock shelf, Heiju pointed across a gulf. See him? Who? I saw only a rock face. Keep looking, he said, and from the mountainside emerged the carved features of a cross-legged giant. One slender hand was raised in a gesture of grace. Weaponry and elements had strafed, ravaged, and cracked his features, but his outline was discernible if you knew where to look. I said the giant reminded me of Timothy Cavendish, making Heiju Im smile for the first time in a long while. He said the giant was a deity that offered salvation from a meaningless cycle of birth and rebirth, and perhaps the cracked stonework still possessed a lingering divinity. Only the inanimate can be so alive. I suppose Quarry Corp will destroy him when they get around to processing those mountains.
Why did Im take you on this field trip to the middle of nowhere?
Every nowhere is somewhere, archivist. Past the cross-legged giant and over the ridge we came upon a modest grain bed in a clearing, clothes drying on bushes, vegetable plots, a crude irrigation system of bamboo, a cemetery, a thirsty cataract. Heiju led me through a narrow cleft into a courtyard, walled by ornate buildings unlike any I ever saw. A very recent explosion had cratered the flagstones, blown away timbers, and collapsed a tile roof. One pagoda had succumbed to a typhoon and fallen on its twin. Ivy, more than joinery, kept the ladder upright. This was to be our lodging for the night, Heiju told me. An abbey had stood there for 15 centuries, until corpocracy dissolved the pre-consumer religions after the skirmishes. Now the site served to shelter dispossessed purebloods who prefer scraping a life from the mountainside to downstrata conurb life.
So Union hid its interlocutor, its Messiah, in a colony of recidivists?
Messiah, what a grandiose title for a Papa Song server. Behind us, a creased, sun-scorched peasant woman, as visibly aged as a senior from Cavendish's time, limped into the courtyard, leaning on an NSF-scarved boy. The boy, a mute, smiled shyly at Heiju, and the woman hugged Heiju affectionately as a mother. I was introduced to the abbess as Ms. Yu. One eye was milk-blind, her other bright and watchful. She clasped my hands in hers in a charming gesture. "You are welcome here," she told me. "Most welcome." Heiju asked about the bomb crater. The abbess replied that a local unanimity regiment was using them for teething. An arrow appeared last month and launched a shell without warning. One man died, and several colonists were badly injured. An act of malice, the abbess speculated sadly, or a bored pilot. Or perhaps a developer had seen potential in the site as a health spa hotel for execs and wanted the site cleared. My companion promised to find out. Who were these colonists exactly? Squatters? Terrorists? Union? Each colonist had a different story. I was introduced to Uyghur dissidents, dust-bowled farmers from Ho Chi Minh Delta, once respectable conurb dwellers who had fallen foul of corp politics, unemployable deviants, those undollared by mental illness. Of the 75 colonists, the youngest was 9 weeks old. The oldest, the abbess, was 68. Though if she had claimed to be 300 years of age, I would still have believed her. Such gravitas she had.
But how could people there survive without franchises and gallerias? What did they eat, drink? How about electricity, entertainment? What about enforcers and order? How did they impose hierarchy?
Go visit them, archivist. You can tell the abbess I sent you.
No?
Well, their food came from the forest and gardens, water from the cataract. Scavenge trips to landfills yielded plastics and metals for tools. Their school Sony was powered by a water turbine. Solar night lamps recharged during daylight hours. Their entertainment was themselves. Consumers cannot exist without 3D and AdV, but humans once did and still can. Enforcement? Problems arose, no doubt, even crises from time to time. But no crisis is insuperable if people cooperate.
What about the mountain winters?
They survived as 15 centuries of nuns had before them, by planning, thrift, and fortitude. The monastery was built over a cave, extended by bandits during the Japanese annexation. These tunnels gave sufficient shelter from winter and unanimity arrows. Oh, such a life is no bucolic utopia. Yes, winters are severe. Rainy seasons are relentless. Crops fall prey to disease. Their medicine is sorely limited. Few colonists live as long as upstrata consumers. They bicker, blame, and grieve as people will, but at least they do it in a community, and companionship is a fine medicine in itself. Neosocopros has no communities now, only mutually suspicious substrata. I slept soundly that night, against a backdrop of gossip, music, complaints, and laughter, feeling safe for the first time since my dorm room in Papa Song's.
So what was Union's interest in the colony?
Simple. Union provides hardware, such as their solars. In return, the colony provides a safe house, kilometers from the nearest eye. I woke in my dorm tunnel just before dawn and crept to the temple mouth. The guard was a middle-aged woman nursing a colt and a stimulant brew. She lifted the mosquito net for me but warned me about coyotes scavenging below the monastery walls. I promised to stay in earshot, skirted the courtyard, and squeezed between the narrow rocks to the balcony of blacks and grays. The mountain dropped away. An updraft rose from the valley, carrying animal cries, calls, growls, and snuffles. I could not identify even one. For all my knowledge of censored arcana, I felt impoverished.